Normally, at the beginning of our Monday Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason podcast, we start with a little found audio, usually of an American politician saying something stupid or at least disputable in some way. But since our main topic today is a war of written words being fought by just about every single person who describes himself as conservative these days, the only appropriate audio I think would be the fight scene in Blazing Saddles, and that's been vetoed for good reason, because, you know, too soon. Hi, everyone. This is Matt Welch here, along with Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Good morning, my friends.
Good morning, my friend.
Happy Monday.
Matt, how are you, Matt?
Matt's great. Thank you for asking. So let's set up the discussion here. 2019 has been already something of manifesto season among the right-of-center commentariat. It was the nationalist moment, according to James Antle in The American Conservative. Chris DeMuth in the Claremont Review of Books declares that Trumpism is the American version of the revival of the spirit of nationhood in the rich democracies of the North Atlantic. A bunch of fairly well-known writers at First Things jointly declared recently that there is no returning to the pre-Trump conservative consensus that collapsed in 2016, and that, among other things, quote, we oppose the soulless society of individual affluence, unquote. This will be a theme recurring, by the way. One of the co-signers of that, New York Post opinion editor Sohrab Amari, set off the latest last week of crazy conservative bar fighting about 8 days ago, when he literally reacted to a Facebook advertisement for a children's drag queen reading hour at a public library in Sacramento. Let you all digest that by tweeting, quote, if you can't see why children belong nowhere near drag with its currents of transvestic fetishism, we have nothing to say to each other. We are irreconcilably opposed. There's no polite David Frenchian third way around the cultural civil war. The only way is through, unquote. David French, for you normies out there, is a writer for National Review. He also used to be the head or a big litigator of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which does campus free speech work. And for about 10 days in 2016, he was the great Never Trump presidential hope. And that obviously ended up in tears. Amari then followed up that swipe with a column titled, and I'm not making this up, Against David Frenchism. And away we went in all of this. If you're seeking further background on all this, please consult Robbie Suave's piece from Friday here. There are so many interesting things that we could talk about that spring from all of this, all these subplots and everything else. But Catherine, I wanted to start with you. Just kind of by drilling down into the Archduke Ferdinand assassination moment of all of this, which is, what does it say about American politics in 2019 that we've just spent a week, I don't know about we, but a lot of people have spent the past week absolutely smashing each other over the face, having to do with drag queen reading hour in Sacramento?
I think it says Archduke Ferdinand-like things, at least for the intellectual right, such as it is, which is to say a bunch of people got pissed off over kind of interpersonal entanglements and are now going to do something so catastrophically self-defeating that the all of like art, literature, and politics will be a smoking ruin for a little while, and then the trauma will linger forever. So and again, I think this is actually mostly just in the realm of the intellectual right, which the election of Trump to me actually showed the intellectual right was not a very important force. And in many ways, people think of libertarians and indeed even Reason Magazine as part of that, right? So this is a reckoning for all of us. I think we've talked about that on this podcast before. At the same time, the thing that many people on the right have decided to do, and that I do think the sort of central document here is that First Things manifesto that you referenced, is to abandon the principles of political liberalism and pluralism. In the traditional sense. So basically to say we no longer think that creating a maximum amount of autonomy for individual choice in the service of keeping space for religious freedom and for traditional values and traditional communities as well as those who would not like to participate in those things, is a viable compromise. I still think that's a viable compromise. I understand why these folks are feeling grumpy and pessimistic about living the particular life they want to live right now. But they, the drag queen happy hour thing, to me, is a shift. And it's also part of this shift to suddenly asking the question of whether we should re-embrace nationalism. If everything is going to be identity politics, maybe the identity politics of this particular thread of the intellectual right is nationalism. That didn't work out super well last time. I would rather not.
Peter, you live in Washington, and you probably
still live in Washington. That's true.
A higher, much higher tolerance than I do for the people who kind of adjectivize their cons, by which I mean reformocons, neocons, theocons, paleocons, crunchy cons.
Ooh, I remember the crunchy
right?
cons.
Crunchy cons. Con Carol, obviously. how much of this, I mean, Catherine referenced the sort of, this is a discussion among the kind of intellectual political right amongst themselves. How much of this can be sort of quickly and perhaps even cynically explained by a, you know, Washington has a permanent class of people who write about politics for a living, and they're just trying to dress up their relationship slash reaction to the current power center of the presidency with some noble and intellectually interesting sounding adjectives.
Well, they're certainly not trying to dress it up in drag. They are.
That would be wrong because of the children.
Yes. And I would also there's certainly, but there is, yes, there is some of that is going on. And you know, I think the weirdest part of Amari's piece on David French is when he praises Donald Trump for basically for being real good for the social conservatives. He says, with a kind of animal instinct, Trump understood what was missing from mainstream, more or less Frenchian conservatism. His instinct has been, Trump's instinct has been to shift the cultural and political mix ever so slightly away from autonomy above all toward order, continuity, and social cohesion. This is a guy who, like, in his campaign rallies regularly featured, you know, Trump saying, hey, you should beat up protesters. Trump slept with a porn star, paid off a porn star. We all we don't
that
need
there's
to.
There's anything wrong with that.
Right. But like,
for us,
as a social conservative hero, right, like the grab him by the pussy guy just doesn't seem like a particularly obvious candidate. And Trump is even this week tweeting that, you know, lesbian and gay Americans have contributed so much to this country and we need to be proud, you know, of them and recognize all of their contributions, which is true, by the way. It's totally right. Trump is right on this. I do not often praise Trump on this podcast, but I would actually point you back to just a couple of days before this set of manifestos and responses broke out. And Amari was complaining about presentations of gay marriage on public television, on Twitter. And there was like a little mini discussion that broke
out. Was he part of the people that were mad about Arthur?
Well, yes, that's it was
the
about
cartoon
Arthur.
Mouse gay marriage.
Cartoon aardvark.
You guys were all over me with that fact check, by the way.
Just, so cartoon aardvark's gay marriage.
We're not
public
entitled
television.
To our own facts.
And like he was pretty upset about that. You know, he didn't want children being exposed to this wholly unnatural way of blah 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 whatever. That public television should be for the common good, and well, there shouldn't be public television. And there's an argument about whether libertarians believed in censorship of public television or something that like everyone was wrong on, because the actual libertarian position is just
no public television,
and none of them could figure this out, which was hilarious. And then you go and so I want to contrast that with his with what then happened in the aftermath, where Charles Cook of National Review got into a tiff with Matthew Schmidt of First Things, and Schmidt, who is defending the Amariist position, ends with sort of like his final salvo is, well, I can't believe David French in his response referenced Game of Thrones, a show with nudity.
Violence and nudity.
Violence. And like, and that
shows he's not really a social conservative, question mark?
Yeah, and that was like, oh, that's how you can tell that this is just a man who is vulgar and awful. And so you like that is what this is about. It is about not allowing people to have fun. It is about being against Arthur and Game of Thrones. And, like, there's no program here. There's nothing other than, like, on the one hand, we're pro-Trump, even though he's the most sort of overtly vulgar and crass president in recent memory. I think even more so than Bill Clinton. And on the other hand, like, you should feel bad that you watch Game of Thrones, you person who likes things.
So here's the thing, though. I actually, that piece of it to me, like, this is a bit against fun. And it's because there is, as I think, a genuinely felt sense on the part of this particular type of social conservative.
That fun is bad.
That America's been having too much fun. That America's actually been having too much fun and neglecting the deeper, more important things. Now, I disagree, but that to me at least seems weirdly lightly defensible.
One of the deeper and more important things.
But to me, the thing that is baffling, and I think is also the least ad hominem attack one can make on these people, is their claim that this all stems, all of our current problems, or many of them, stem from the fact that libertarians have been winning for too long. And that is the piece that blows my mind, because... Whoa.
Doesn't everybody
maybe
on this,
have, right?
on this like podcast maybe, feel like we've just won so hard?
Right. So this is, we've talked about this lots of times here, and maybe we have won in some sense. Maybe it actually is true that the deepest libertarian idea that, like, a liberal rights-respecting order that maximizes choice is a thing broadly that we have moved toward in the last several decades. I think that's true. But the idea that libertinism, which is, like, that's always the best dog whistle for when you've got, like, a real social conservative writing, is when they refer to libertinism, which, like, no one uses that word except these dudes to mean us, which is a weird turn of events because, frankly, we're not that good of libertines.
To mean you, Catherine Mengu Ward, with your children and
me
your
personally,
marriage
with my
your,
utterly conventional
your Ivy
life.
League degree and your, like, your the, yacht.
Yes.
You know,
and
one of the things that this
that,
is all...
that to me is the question. I think that the starting place is the Tucker Carlson January monologue,
yep.
where he says we have to stop caring about economic growth and material prosperity and restructure our politics and our commercial culture around traditional values, including, you know, family and faith.
One of the touchstones of which, although he doesn't cite, Tucker did not cite Orrin Cass, the new Orrin Cass book, which one of the primary arguments was that we overrate economic growth as a public policy goal.
One of the, you know, the lurking things here, and it's in the First Things Manifesto, it's in a lot of National Review conservative talk, are attacks on individual autonomy, which is, you know, ultimately a libertarian principle that, you know, maximizing individual autonomy and respecting and giving it room to flourish and to fail or to succeed is central to, you know, human flourishing. That's what they're against, the First Things people, but also often many of the National Review people. And I think looking at this, not, I don't give a shit about the conservative, you know, sects warring with each other. I do think from a libertarian perspective, it's extremely interesting that to the extent that conservatives now, National Review conservatives, have to at least pretend to abide by kind of liberalism, classical liberalism and a marketplace of ideas and a celebration of all that allows in terms of speech, in terms of argumentation, in terms of lifestyle experimentation. I think that is a gigantic win for a libertarian sensibility. And that sensibility can be either right wing or left wing or neither. It can just be pure libertarian. I was struck, you know, as this was happening today, Jonah Goldberg, who's been at National Review for about 20 or 21 years, who's leaving to start a new thing with Steve Hayes, the former head of the Weekly Standard, which is out of business because of changes in the conservative kind of media political landscape post-Donald Trump. Jonah Goldberg is actually now talking about letting a thousand flowers bloom in a way that explicitly in attacking Reason and me and Virginia Pastrell and Andrew Sullivan 20 years ago, he's embracing what he was then critiquing us for, which was the idea that you know, as long as people are free to exit systems that they're uncomfortable with or give voice against them, you know, he's in favor of that now. In the past, he accused us of what he called cultural libertarianism and the idea that you could just pick and choose from various traditions and make your own culture. You know, I think we've won. And I think it's, you know, it's kind of fun to see conservatives beat up on each other. I think the larger question is, what do we do with this?
One thing that has struck me over the past week and also in reading George Will's new book, which is called The Conservative Sensibility, is how much the phrase classical liberal has been thrown around as a positive self-identifier. I don't think I've seen it used this much, this positively, since, you know, the last time some group of libertarians wanted to stop calling themselves libertarians, which is where I've usually seen it over the years. But Catherine, you're about ready to talk, so I'll tee you up a little bit on that, which is to say, Nick says, and rightly so, that it's interesting to watch a lot of people, you know, like National Review type of conservatives, call themselves classical liberals and also point very specifically toward the actual tenets of classical liberalism and celebrating that. And those are exactly the people who now find themselves kind of flung into the universe away from the modern Republican Party and increasingly away from modern conservatism. So what does it say that the people who embrace this thing then become ideologically homeless? And what is your message to those people, Catherine?
So I feel like I joined libertarianism broadly around the time that the last spasm of, hey, maybe we should really be calling ourselves classical liberals, was ending, which was in the 90s, in the late 90s. And I think there was, I agree that there are sort of these moments when people are like, well, you know, I don't like any of the things out there, but I do like liberalism. Like, I do like liberalism in the traditional European sense. And hey, there's this word out there that kind of means that. So maybe I'll call myself that. But libertarianism sounds like there's too much long hair and too many pot smokers or something.
There's
there.
Like an extra T that just doesn't need to be there.
Yeah, something. There's just like a little too much loosey goosiness out there. Like, you know, the classical liberalism solves that problem. So I do think there is a desire for sort of respectability libertarianism as an alternative to what is increasingly like terrifying authoritarian nationalist conservatism. And maybe this is a moment for reflection for us, right? That the people who were doing some version of respectability libertarian also kind of became the alt-right, maybe. The
Wait,
people,
what do you mean?
I know. Give me a hot second. Calm your pants, everybody. That there always has been within libertarianism branches of people who say the Western tradition is important. The conventions of a free society demand personal responsibility, with a lot of emphasis on the personal responsibility, and some of that rhetoric was the rhetoric that that the folks who once identified as libertarians and then left, and please, like, let the door hit them in the ass on the way out. They were never really libertarians. But this language about Western values and order and rule of law and the responsibility that comes with liberty that turned into the kind of white nationalist alt-right thing, these people are looking for an alternative to that. These people are looking for an alternative to both our thing and that thing, and there's no space for that.
Who are those people?
I don't know if I agree with that. So I would say two things here, and one is, I think you're right that there is a searching aspect to this. There is a sort of exploratory. There is something of a throwback aspect as well, right? Like,
wait,
they
who
kind
is
of want
exploring?
To,
who is looking
the first
for
thing,
something?
The First Things crowd, the Amariists, the people who signed the First Things manifesto, Sohrab Amari, and all of the people who sort of agree.
They are
with
expressing
that.
A dissatisfaction with yes. all of the available current
right.
alternatives,
and they are trying also to hitch it to Trump, since these people tend to like authority. And like central authority figures.
They
and
also
they
like
him
nationalism, and he's
yes.
a nationalist. I mean,
and
his
they
economic
like the,
policies.
Like nationalism, and, yes, that is correct. And so they're trying to hitch it to Trump, and I don't think that that makes any sense at all. Just kind of, it's just incoherent. But there is an effort to do that, and they're trying to. But they are looking for an agenda. And this is a thing that Republicans have been doing now basically since the Iraq War, is that Republicans have increasingly been a party without an agenda, without a real coherent sort of policy program. And that you see, I think, the most coherent, and I don't want to say best, but there's parts of it even that I agree with. The smartest version of this is the Orrin Cass book, which really is a detailed and thoughtful policy program with, as I reviewed it, I think it has a lot of problems. There's a lot of it that I disagree with. It goes too far. It sort of tries to solve the problem of despair in people's souls using a whole bunch of technocratic policy levers, but it's an agenda. And if you look at the Republican Party right now, look at what they're running on. What are they running on? They're running on basically three things. If you're not Donald Trump, well, even if you are Donald Trump, they're running on, number one, we love Donald Trump. That's not an agenda. I guess it's a promise not to impeach, but it's not a promise to do a specific thing. They're running on, we won't do socialism, which again is not an actual agenda of a thing they will do. It's just a thing that they won't. It's, we won't do socialism like Democrats will. And three, we'll do some trade and immigration stuff, and especially we'll restrict immigration. And so that's the closest thing they have to an agenda right now. And this is an attempt to flesh out the rest of it. And I think it's pretty telling that, you know, it's the Amari part of this is pretty empty when it comes to actual policy specifics. It's not really clear what they want to do besides not have Arthur on public television.
Who's an aardvark, by
well,
the way.
No, but there are so, I think you're really scanting the idea that conservatives don't have a policy agenda, the Republicans don't. They're in favor of economic nationalism, and they've pushed through, and Congress is happy to play along with it to the extent you don't hear Republicans talking against it, and you hear more of them embracing things like tariffs. Immigration is a huge thing, and has been for National Review, has been pushing extensively restrictionist immigration policy for at least 25 years, if not more. They are anti-abortion in the extreme. They're in favor of cutting taxes, which they actually did. They don't have a healthcare plan, but they're against an extension or an expansion of Obamacare, and certainly against Medicare for All, even if they like Medicare for old people who vote Republican. They're also in favor of paid family leave, increasingly on the right among conservative think tanks that would have been screaming bloody socialism 20 years ago. You have groups like the Independent Women's Forum that's actually pushing that, as is Ivanka Trump, as are a number, increasing number of pro, you know, kid having more kids among right wingers.
I would put paid family leave in the kind of group of searching for a new right agenda.
But I'm saying it's there. There's legislation and there are plans that are being pushed. So I think this idea, to be quite honest, I think the idea that Trump doesn't have an agenda or the Republicans under Trump don't have an agenda is somewhat off. And then there's the question about foreign policy as well. That's a place where I think the country on both sides, you know, people are grasping. Neither party has a coherent or consensus is probably a better term, foreign policy. But I think there's a lot of policy stuff that is happening. It's not as extensive and it's not
as
But
I guess
forward.
I would say that the Republican, the right agenda such that it exists is largely a cultural agenda. And yes, that it has economic consequences, certainly when tariffs and
I don't think immigration or tariffs are simply cultural issues. I mean, that's and also government spending and taxes. Taxes is not an economic issue.
But taxes is just this sort of dead end tax cuts without spending cuts forever. Right. It's barely an agenda. It's just let's pull the same lever we've been pulling before forever.
And I don't disagree with that, but they've never cut
spending. With the major issues, which are healthcare, education, and housing. And that's what Democrats are focused on.
Just to intrude for a moment here, I would point out that in the the French Amari wars and in the kind of different ways that it maps out, a consistent critique among the First Things crowd is that the dead consensus that they are against includes slavish devotion to tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. So they're against that. Like to the extent that there's intellectual Trumpism, they tend to question the tax cuts piece of all of that, which I think
is one of the reasons why it's weird to try and hitch this particular social conservative agenda to Trump.
You know who actually saw this coming is David Brooks. In April of 2018, he wrote a column called A Renaissance on the Right, and here is the list of people that he named. Amari, Helen Andrews, Charles Cook, Molly Hemingway, Jason Willock, Michael Brendan Doherty, Gracie Olmsted, James Poulos, Orrin Cass, Matthew Schmitz, and many others.
Like, David Brooks has been writing that column every
year for
15 years.
This time he was right. This time he was right. Like,
it was Will Wilkinson, Megan McArdle,
I know.
Maybe Peter Sermon.
Megan McArdle, James Poulos, full disclosure, is my wife and is delightful.
James Poulos was on the list both times, which is impressive that he could
Carrie
be an up-and-coming new... Anyway, the point is he was completely right. This column says there are a bunch of conservatives out there who have put at the center of their conservative critique that modern liberal capitalism is too soulless, atomizing, and destructive of basic institutions. These people are going to fight fire with fire using identitarian politics to fight identitarian politics. And that is what's happening. He was right.
Before we get into my extended David Brooks analysis here, and perhaps before whatever Nick was going to say, though, maybe I'll tee it up.
Everyone should go read Matt Welch's cover story on David Brooks from a few years ago.
Classic. It's a modern classic.
A modern classic. Now we've distracted me from what else. No, the critique underlying a lot of the kind of the first things side of this, and Suderman referenced this explicitly, sort of like the soullessness of what modern capitalism has delivered. We've seen a lot of different series of books that have come out. Tim Carney's book is sort of about this. Ben Sasse has been touching on this. Mike Lee talks about this in various ways. We see it reflected, perhaps, depending on how you look at things, in the increase of mortality rates among basically middle-aged white dudes without college degrees, and other things like that. I would like us to address that issue on itself. Is there not a kind of a weird drifting unhappiness across the land? And did Nick Gillespie contribute to it directly through his neoliberalism? Nick, you want to address that?
Yeah, I think that we're in the midst of telling ourselves a bunch of fake stories about how dire and awful American or life is in the 21st century. And so we, both on the right and the left, for different reasons, tend to say that, actually most of the income gains in the past 20 years have gone to a small group of people who get richer and richer and kind of piss on everybody else, that there are increasing numbers of deaths of despair that are due to, kind of liberal trade policy and globalization and things like that, there's no way that poor people can get ahead anymore in American society, that the world is more dangerous and fraught with more inequality. I think that the stories we tell ourselves all point to decline because both conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats, benefit from taking over in a world that's in crisis. And in fact, almost the exact opposite is true, and that there is an enormous amount of social progress that is constantly being made, technological progress that is being made, and other forms of liberation and fulfillment and possibility. And that's the essential, from a journalistic point of view, I think that's one of the essential functions that Reason serves, is both to document how these stories, the scare stories, are wrong, and also what's going on that's increasing and improving and generally better.
But this is also the great power of what this, again, tiny subset of a tiny subset of people who maybe don't actually have any power, intellectual conservatives, are saying, that makes it so interesting, is that they are just waving away all of that. They are saying it doesn't actually matter whether infant mortality is at an all-time low. It doesn't actually matter whether people are, have more purchasing power than ever before. None of that matters. Those things are baubles. They are distractions from the true, long-term, immortal values. To me, though, the question is, let's say that they're right. They're not. They're not right. They're very wrong. But let's say that they're right. There's still this question of, like, there's like an underpants gnomes problem. Like, there's just a, like, okay, sure, what really matters is faith and family and the nation. Sure. So... what what now? How do we get to a world where those things matter? And certainly Donald Trump doesn't get us to that world for reasons that Peter has just outlined. And certainly the Republican Party, it's currently constituted, doesn't get us to that world. And certainly essays in First Things don't get us to that world. So how?
Right. They have this phrase, the common good and even the highest good. And it's totally unclear what policies you could, or steps, like meaningful steps you could take to create a government that promotes the common and the highest good, whatever that is, because no one knows what that is.
But this is why liberals are flipping their hats about The Handmaid's Tale.
They know what the common good is on the right, and the left knows what the common good is on the right. And one of the things that I think is particularly interesting from a libertarian perspective of this moment is that this is going to force an increasing number, and we've already started to see this with Never Trump conservatives, kind of having to embrace their inner libertarian, and they may call themselves classical liberal for a while, but they have to vacate old hoary institutions on the right, including the National Review, which really doesn't have that much when you get down to it. They don't have many policy differences with a lot of the people at First Things or other conservatives, but they're going to have to embrace the idea that they believe in a liberal order. And then, you know, what you do next, Catherine, I think, is not on the right or the left, because they, you know, and you know, they'll say, we have the right answer and we're going to shove it down people's throats and we're not going to allow dissent or anything like that, because that way madness lies. It's going to be up to the rest of us to run our experiments in living and, you know, through suasion and example, pull more people into a utopia of utopias.
And I think it's happening.
The common good thing, though, I think is it's worth going back to. Yes, maybe they know what it is, but in practice, what it translates to is Game of Thrones is smutty, and you should feel bad for liking it. And when I started by saying that what they're really against is fun, and what they're really against is sort of joyful engagement with culture and ideas, that's because I think that not all of it, but a lot of what their stance is that it boils down to a kind of a sneering, prudish sense that stuff is just bad, and we should be above it, and we should condemn it. I don't talk about this a whole lot, but like I grew up in a pretty conservative religious community. I went to a Christian college for the first half of my college career, an explicitly Christian college where you had mandatory chapel attendance, that sort of thing. And a lot of why I have left that community and that part of the world, I still have very good friends who are involved in it quite deeply, and I still respect a lot of those people. But a lot of why I left that world is because there is this sort of cultural authoritarianism, this kind of soft tea tyranny to it, where it mostly expresses itself in the idea that what you like is not something that is okay to like, because it is destroying, it's corrupting your soul, it's making the world worse for children. And no, like it is a denial of joy and pleasure in experiencing the world, and it's awful.
I think the other piece of that, though, is like, I actually appreciate that you expanded on that a little bit, because I think I was reading your argument just now as like, they're just meanies. Right. Like they just don't like fun. And I think that it's always a mistake to argue from the disposition of your opponents. Right. But I think they don't like fun in the service of the greater good makes more sense. I think there is, though, also a reaction. There's a reactionary element in both the highfalutin sense and in the like very low level personal sense. Like they are reactionary. They're reacting against what exists now. They're reacting against the status quo and the perceived decadence of that status quo.
They find it ugly and personally distasteful.
But there is also, I think, when the left says what the right wants is The Handmaid's Tale, what the right wants is theocracy. There's a certain, like, I think when someone says that to you enough times, though I don't think it is morally laudatory, I am sympathetic to the fact that some percentage of these people might just say, fine. If you think I'm a monster, if you think I actually want The Handmaid's Tale, fine. Let's do that then. I'm going to actually advocate for the freaking Handmaid's Tale. I am going to do it. And like, I have felt that temptation myself, right? When Reason has published its 8,000th article about social, about poverty remedies, or about how, like, the police hurt Black people every day, and someone says, you don't care about Black people or the poor, I am sometimes tempted to be like, fine, I'm just going to get my monocle and my martini glass, and I'm going to go get on Charles Koch's yacht and screw all y'all. But I don't. Because
actually you do care about, because I actually do care about these things.
And so this is my, this is ultimately my question, is like, when this group of conservatives leans into, yeah, we basically are going to think about building a nationalist theocracy, you know, a nicer one than Handmaid's Tale maybe, but still, that, like, was being a monster a pleasure they were previously denying themselves? Because that's not how I feel about it. But maybe
it's important to recognize that the right, broadly speaking, and again, it's not even worth making distinctions between National Review, Commentary, and First Things on this score. They have lost every culture war battle that they have entered. And that's what they're pissed about. And, like, you know, National Review and First Things can now fight as if they're bitter enemies, but they're really not. And they're just gradations on the anchor, you know, that is supposed to, you know, that's yelling stop on where society is going. And
wow, they're bitter, Matt Welsh.
They're bitter, and they're, you know, they're fading. This is the, you know, the First Thing stuff is the thrashing of a dying beast. It's not going anywhere. It's not going to build things. I think the one positive thing is that it might force a bunch of conservative people who think they're conservatives to be like, oh, fuck it. You know what? Almost 20 years into the 21st century, I'm actually not conservative. I'm libertarian.
A couple of things to point out. One, I find it kind of interesting that David French is in the middle of this fight, and as I mentioned at the top, he was floated by Bill Kristol, former Weekly Standard editor, as a co-inheritor of neoconservatism, as a never Trump presidential candidate for a week or two in 2016. It's interesting to see that the never Trump Kristolian effort to look for a GOP primary challenger has produced nothing. I mean, for a while, it was going to be Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland. He just announced over the weekend, nope, that's not going to happen. John Kasich has some kind of long running, oh, I might run, I might not thing as part of his CNN gig, but he's not going to run most likely. And what you're left with is, at this point, the person who ran as a libertarian in 2016 for vice president, Bill Weld, he's the only person competing against Trump. And now you're seeing a lot of the energy of the kind of conservative, not Trump people floating towards Justin Amash, who couldn't be less neoconservative unless you hatched something from Ron Paul's factory somewhere. So it's kind of fascinating to see the personnel dead endism, at least momentarily now, and the strange bedfellows. And the other thing that I'll point out, since Catherine brought up David Brooks, and that's an evergreen, is that I look at all of this as a strange replay of what happened between, let's say, 2002 and 2006, not with nationalist kind of post-paleocons as we're seeing right now, but with neocons back then, which is to say, they had a president. They had influence on a president. Probably the neocons had more influence on the Bush presidency post 9/11 than intellectual conservatives have on Donald Trump. But still, you know, their team broadly in charge. Hey, it's manifesto season. And the classic of the form, there were a couple, in many senses, the one that was most telling to me was David Brooks' New York Times Magazine cover story from 2004 that was timed with the Republican National Convention in New York City, saying the era of small government conservatism is over. His absolute exultation that the last remnants of Goldwaterism and economic libertarianism had been decisively quashed. And now it's going to be a new and perhaps permanent governing majority on the right, with all this new voices back then, which back then was probably Raihan Salam and Raoul Duthat and whatever. And I will mispronounce that until I die. He overshot. But it's an interesting exercise that we see with whenever there is an ascendant wing of conservatism that is feeling the power rush through its veins, they look around and say, all right, let's purge the libertarians by name, which is kind of weird and kind of wonderful as well. Catherine, do you, you know, like you talked about before sort of how people perceive reason or, you know, there's sort of a historical at least overlap between reason and some of these groupings of human beings. I feel like that's kind of less the case in 2019, partially because of the history of all of this now. But when you see Robbie Suave taking this personally, like they're being mean to libertarians, doesn't part of you say, like, great, that, you know, so it's that's them and we are us.
Yeah, I think the piece of it that makes me bummed is, well, there's a lot of it that makes me bummed, including the rise of, you know, nationalist authoritarianism. But the thing that makes me bummed is if the right was doing this in a slightly alternate history where the left was also not abandoning core liberal principles, then I would be like, okay, let's do this thing that libertarians have been kind of chattering amongst ourselves about for a long time, which is to be like, we are somewhat more at home on the left right now than on the right where we were for much of the late 20th century. Like that's a thing that the libertarians have been talking about for ages. That's not an option for us. That continues to not be an option for us because we have this insane crossover situation happening where exactly at the moment that the left has moved away from the values of free speech and in many ways rule of law and, you know, in some ways freedom of assembly, like some really core ideas that libertarians used to share with the left, civil liberties, like that, the left has moved away from that. And the right looked at the left moving away from that. And instead of being like, welcome people who believe in those things to our lovely coalition that defends those things, the right was like, yeah, we're against those too. We hate that stuff too, which is unfortunate. And I think the, you know, the version of this that has come up this week is like there's the triggering event of this is drag queen library happy hour or whatever. And there is also a left wing critique of drag that is ascendant right now. The drag uses gender and mocks the identity of trans people in ways that are no longer acceptable to the kind of woke left. If we have Michael Brendan Doherty and like purple-haired social justice warrior gal working together to end drag happy hour at the library, something is really wrong. And
oh, I think it's so right.
Whatever's happening there, it exposes some true underlying commonalities that those ends of the spectrum have always had. I think that's true. But it also, to me, says the place for libertarians to make common cause with the left or the right is smaller than it's ever been. There is not. I appreciate Nick's optimistic gloss that some people on the more libertarian right will join us as conservatives become authoritarian. But I think, likewise, we are losing ground with both ends of the spectrum in that way. And I find it, I do not find opportunity for us there.
As an addendum, I would just say, though, that, you know, there's no question that the extremes on the right and the left are getting louder and they're, you know, higher pitched and all of that. But, you know, fewer people are associating with, Democrats and Republicans. Fewer people, I think, identify on those extremes. I think it's a huge opportunity for us because we've seen this.
It's a huge opportunity for Joe Biden.
No, it's not. And, you know, it because we're also pre-political. It's not, we're not going to be partisan, in a traditional sense, but you start to see a lot of people, and over the past couple of years, you've seen people on the left, start to freak out over, you know, as the anti-free speech left has revealed itself, they're like, oh shit, like that's not my tribe. And they might not be comfortable in the libertarian tribe, but they're closer to us than they were 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. I think something like that will happen on the right or has been happening on the right. And it's not always acknowledged as much. But if you look at the people at the Bulwark, which is the rump group that was founded after the Weekly Standard got deep six by its, billionaire money bags, they're much closer to us. And they're also more critical of foreign policy, et cetera. I mean, this this is not a bad place for libertarians to be.
I would also just point out that one of the great benefits or things that writing an endless series of manifestos has is that you can ignore the news of the day, because I think a lot of the manifesto writers, if they actually were looking at, you know, President Trump slapping a bunch of idiot tariffs in Mexico and calling the mayor of London a stupid loser and a bunch of things like that.
And celebrating Pride Month.
And celebrating Pride Month. Like, it just, it's much easier to live in the world of airy ideas rather than the grubby actual place where those ideas are implemented, which looks a hell of a lot different, I think, than a lot of the kind of sketching out of what all this means. And the other thing I'll say is just enough Flight 93 elections. Everyone is just gearing up at every moment for an apocalyptic. That is part of, I think, what you see on both the left and the right right now, is that it's such an easier thing to do to go to a place that provokes your flight or fight response in politics. You see sometimes a sense of relief among people when they get to do it. Well, the other side is about ready to lock us all up. So, you know, there's no third way now. It's all war all the time. And then, you know, it's great because you don't have to think anymore for yourself on some level. And it's not very seemly. I wanted to get to or just transition to our end of show. What are you consuming bit here? Partly because what I'm consuming fits in perfectly with all of this. And I'm hoping that the rest of you will take us away from this. But anyways, I've been reading The Conservative Sensibility by George Will, which is a way of him to sum up 50 years in public life and make the argument for classical liberalism as the conservatism and not some kind of irritable blood and soil nationalism here. It's I found myself very surprisingly in some senses kind of like say yes on almost every single page, which is a weird thing for someone who has never self-identified as conservative. One of the interesting things that he says, kind of getting to Nick's pre-political point, is that sensibility has as much to do with it as ideology. And I'm looking forward to interviewing him this week and asking him why that sensibility doesn't make him embrace the actual word libertarian, because that's kind of where the intellectual side of it has gone. But Peter, what are you consuming?
I have been reading the new Ian McEwan novel, Machines Like Me. It is a...
But definitely those social conservatives are wrong about how we're materialist escapists from the
real values. So McEwan is the author of books like Atonement, right? He's sort of a highfalutin, super upper middle brow British writer, I guess you could call him, right?
He's like very
really
accurate, super upper middle brow.
While also being quite intricate and kind of... attuned to the history of philosophy and in particular science. And so this is a science fiction novel set in the 1980s in an alternate history in which Alan Turing lived and sort of set in motion a great technological revolution so that things like artificial and machine intelligence have progressed far beyond where they are in actual 2019 by the middle of the 1980s. It's a story about a guy who is in his mid 30s and he's sort of bummy and aimless and kind of he plays the stock market online on his computer and he buys one of the very first models of artificial human. And then he and his kind of girlfriend, who lives in the apartment upstairs, end up setting its big five personality traits. And so there's a sort of psychological quiz aspect to this book. There's an Alan Turing aspect to this book. What I'm saying is Catherine Mangu Ward is really going to like it. And it's also about it's about the nature of the self and of love and identity and also the Falklands War.
Speaking of self-love, Nick, what have you been reading?
Yeah, thank you, Matt. Wonderful. Actually, kind of appropriate. I was reading The People versus Lawrence Ferlinghetti by Ronald K.L. Collins and David Scover. The fight to publish Howl. And it's about Lawrence Ferlinghetti, a poet and the owner of City Lights Bookstore, as well as City Lights Publishing in San Francisco, which was one of the main outlets for beat literature, as well as a couple of other experimental and kind of avant-garde boundary-pushing stuff. It's a fantastic story about how in the mid-50s, the publication of Howl became one of the major launching pads for what we know as freedom of expression in the way that we all take it for granted and might be losing it in various ways. I also interviewed Collins for a podcast that'll be coming up either this week or next. He's a good example of a person who's politically a liberal, but is on speech level or speech terms is hyper-libertarian. It's a great rollicking story that is totally kind of unpredictable. And it could have gone the other way, and it would have taken another 25 years, I think, to get the freedom of expression we had. And I also finished Revolutionary Road, the early 60s novel by Richard Yates, which was made into a movie with Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet a few years ago. It is one of the classic novels of suburban despair and kind of deaths of despair of being in a conformist culture, in one that prized material well-being over soulfulness and whatnot. And it's worth reading. It's a very good book, a very dark book, and a very wrong book, ultimately. But it's particularly worth rereading in the moment for all of the reasons we were talking about today, where people are saying, you know, this is the worst of all possible times because nobody has any soul or meaning in their life anymore. So that's what I've been doing.
Before I hand it over to Catherine, I should also mention that by accident, tuned into the last, I think, 10 minutes of a television series that way I would have been totally interested to watch all of if I watched TV, called Fosse Verdon, based on Bob Fosse, the great choreographer.
It's so good.
And Gwen Verdon is a main kind of a muse, co-artist and whatever. But anyways, watching the last 10 minutes of a really good or what seemingly good TV show, it's really a great way to consume it. I highly recommend it, that just in general. And I think I'm going to go out and seek all the different things that people have always talked about and just watch the last 10 minutes of it because it's pretty great. Catherine, go ahead.
Yeah, so I have a follow-up from my last week recommendation, first of all, which is I watched the Good Omens series, the first half of it, and it is very nice. It's delightful. It's not like the greatest great art, but it really scratches the itch, and I think it is relevant to our conversation here because it is about an angel and a demon who are trying to save the world from the apocalypse, and the thing that happens in the end, spoiler, is that the angel and demon just kind of get to know each other over millennia and become pals. And also the Antichrist is just raised by normal people accidentally and is basically just a human. And it works out okay when humans are just humans and try to understand each other as humans instead of a great Manichaean battle between good and evil. Just throwing it out there. That's a thing. But the book that I read, which Peter's recommendation was a very Catherine recommendation, I'm going to return the favor. I am reading Lessons from Lucy, The Simple Joys of an Old Happy Dog by Dave Barry. Guys, I hate dogs so much. I hate
Put them in the pound.
This is Catherine's most wrong opinion.
And it's there. People should not let gross animals live in their house. But this book is by Dave Barry, and it is therefore very funny and very nice and full of a non-ostentatious wisdom that we should all always appreciate, and you should read
That's what dogs are full of, non-ostentatious wisdom that we should appreciate.
They're idiots that only want to eat your garbage, Peter.
And cuddle. Okay. And go for walks. And
anyway, what I'm saying is I hate dogs and I still kind of like this book because I love Dave Barry so much and it's his new book and you should read it, especially if you're old. Like, this book is mostly for old people and it seems like good wisdom for the olds.
I was on Bill Maher with Dave Barry. He was the mid-show add-on guest to talk about his book, and Maher spent the entire time talking about his prostate.
Yep.
About Dave Barry's prostate or
about
his own prostate?
I mean, he made some inquiries about Dave Barry's prostate.
All prostate conversations are really about all prostates, maybe.
Yeah.
Dave Barry is great. I was fortunate to interview him for SiriusXM recently as well, and he came up afterwards in the little like a post show have a drink for 30 minutes party that they do there, and said when they all start like saying these crazy things that you know aren't true, how do you restrain yourself, which is the ultimate experience on Bill Maher. And I thought it was pretty cute. And the answer from Nick Gillespie, obviously, is you don't restrain yourself. You just get in there and do it. But he's delightful. And just the little bit that I've read from that is hilarious and funny. It's always good to read Dave Barry, the greatest newspaper columnist in America, partly because he only writes, I think, one column a year at this point. That's all the time we have for. Thank you for listening to the Reason Podcast, Editor's Roundtable Edition. Keep listening to us and leaving comments wherever you can and supporting us. And see you next week.
The lesson is that actually dogs are good. Mm-mm. Because they love you.
Nope.